Anyway, guys, keep your headphones on. We want to talk about the European crane. Now, the European crane was once so widespread across Ireland that its Irish name, Cor, is that its Irish name, ain't it?
Yeah, Cor, yeah.
Is found in hundreds of place names such as Curra or Crane Meadow in County Kildare. And few birds can rival their cultural footprint with connections to Fionn Mac Cuil, the Druids, St. Colum Kill, and the Book of Kells, with research suggesting they were once the third most common pet after dogs and cats during the Brehon Law period. And now, some 400 years since becoming extinct here, they're making a comeback of sorts in County Donegal. That's the sound of a European crane heard in County Donegal. We're joined now by Cillian McLaughlin, who's added two pairs of European crane to the Wild Ireland Reserve in Inishowen. And he joins us now from the studios in Derry. Hello, Cillian, how are you?
Hello, Derek, I'm well.
First of all, let's explain what the Wild Ireland Reserve is for the benefit of the listeners.
So the Wild Ireland Reserve is a 23-acre wildlife sanctuary set in a forest. I just heard you talking about a forest there, and it's a natural temperate rainforest. So we have all native trees with mosses and ferns growing on the trees. And in amongst this forest, I have created habitats for native animals and native animals that are now long since extinct in Ireland. And I've offered sanctuary to animals that have needed rescuing from horrendous situations around the world. And I've also offered sanctuary to other animals locally that have needed a place to come and live out their lives where they can't return to the wild for various reasons. And I'm open to the public. So a big part of the work that I do is educating people about the forest, about the animals that we still have, and of course the animals that we have lost. And a big part of the message of Wild Ireland is if we don't look after the animals that we have today, such as our red squirrels, our badgers, our pine martens, that they will also go the way of the bears, the wolves, the lynx, and unfortunately will never return.
Now, can I just clarify for the benefit of everybody listening that you're not actually reintroducing these species? You have just imported them into your wildlife reserve.
Correct.
Yeah, so I kind of tongue-in-cheek saying, is it possibly on the way back? So you have brought four cranes in, that's two pairs, is that correct?
Correct,
so
yes.
So two males, two females?
Two males, two females.
Are they breeding pairs?
The indications are there that they are starting to pair up, Derek. They've certainly started to dance with each other. And that's a very positive sign that there is possibly some courtship underway.
Now tell us about the dancing. Describe it.
To refer to a classic Irish phrase, to throw shapes, and I think that's a pretty good description of what they do.
They do it in here on this programme all the time. Richard and Nain are always dancing with each other.
Yes.
But go on, Amy, describe it.
Don't tell everybody.
They literally throw shapes. They throw their body into a position and they freeze in that position, and then they throw their body the opposite way, and the wings and the long neck and the head moves and then stops. Almost like the robot, for want of a better description. And then they'll also throw their heads back in the air. Their sort of dagger-like beak will point skywards, and they open it and they emit this beautiful call. And it's actually, there's a beautiful Irish phrase to describe that as Cor Gaira, which means crane laughter. And I think that's just a beautiful phrase that describes the call perfectly.
You've seen this in Japan, Niall, have you not? But not the European crane, obviously.
No, I did see a vagrant European crane there, but no, the species there in Japan, the red crown crane, or the Japanese crane, they do this amazing dance.
Very elaborate.
It really is, and in Japanese culture, it's almost sacred. It goes back in mythology for generations, and you find that with many crane species around the world. There's something that people really like about them: this dance, the ornate behaviour they have, but also I suppose this faithfulness between the pair. They do this sort of, this is a pair strengthening exercise that they do. They're very faithful birds, and I think that's a trait that humans admire in them. Really impressive birds. I suppose that, you know, many listeners around the country would use the word crane. In parts of Ireland, when we lost our real cranes, the name became transferred to a different bird to many people.
It's
the grey heron, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And the grey heron itself is an impressive creature, quite common, especially in wetland areas. But the true crane, the common crane, or the European crane, is an even more impressive bird. It's absolutely massive to begin with. Could you describe them for us, please? Tell us what they're like.
They're a very tall bird, as you rightly point out. I mean, they come up, when they stretch up, they probably come up to my shoulder. So they look you almost in the eye, which is quite intimidating when they have a big dagger-like beak.
Can imagine,
they're not They're not aggressive, though. They're really not aggressive. They're quite endearing birds, very trusting birds as well. And when Derek talked about them being the third most common pet in Ireland, I can really see how they were tamed so easily. In the short time that they've been with me, they've become very trusting. They're grey and white in colour. They have a red patch of skin on the top of their heads. They've been described as having a stately poise, and I really like that as it describes the way they stand and the way they hold themselves. And there was an old legend that the crane used to, like other birds, they'll stand on one foot. And the old legend goes that the crane would hold a stone in the other foot, the one that was off the ground, so that if it drifted off, the stone would drop and it would wake the crane up again, so that it was never complacent or never sleeping on the job, so to speak.
It's interesting about these displays. This is a curiously divided kind of species. They are very solitary, the pairs, when they breed, but they're very gregarious the rest of the time. So all this displaying might have something to do with ensuring the monogamy, because they're long-term monogamous, because they're in the midst of all together, so they have to lock on to their right partner and then go off and breed quietly on their own. They're a strange lot. But their most extraordinary feature is in India. They breed in Russia and then they fly south to India. But they have to go over the Himalayas up 6,500 metres. A most incredible feat to do. They do it in one day. They go right across and down the other side. And everyone thought strange things about this. They thought that they headed off in the morning. They don't. They head off in the evening. And the explanation for that seems to be that the rising thermals carry them up and then the cold air of the night is thicker, so they're able to fly better in the cool of the night. They're able to stay and they have more oxygen in the cool air the night, and they can dissipate the heat in their flight muscles. So this is an extraordinary accomplishment that they do. It's been very much researched in another species, the bar-headed goose, by a fellow in Wales. Now, I think the crane is an extraordinary creature. The other odd thing about him is that he's very like swans in that the babies must be taught the migration route by their parents. They're taken to the winter haunt and they're taken back to the breeding haunt. Now the interesting thing about that is it has set up patterns of migration. They fly in great V's and people in Eastern Europe see these coming across at certain times of the year, so the crane has become celebrated. Oh, there's the cranes, that's the big signal that it's the spring or it's the autumn or whatever. So this has led to the affection for them, this trait of having to teach their youngsters, and the youngsters of course teach their youngsters, and so it gets established.
What's interesting is in recent years we have started to see more cranes turning up in Ireland, and there's some debate over whether these are, you know, are vagrants that have come here by accident or if it's actually part of a sort of a natural range expansion or recolonisation, because it's got to the stage where in Ireland, although it's quite a scarce bird to see, or a very scarce bird to see, it's no longer really a rarity anymore. You'd expect to get a couple each year, sometimes even to see flocks, which is
so where would they nest? I mean, either the marsh birds, they walk around eating things like frogs and all kinds of creepy crawlies that they can find, and they eat grain as well, so they're omnivores. But do they nest in trees, or where do they build their nests?
They nest on the ground, and that unfortunately makes them more vulnerable than a lot of other water birds.
Because the herons nest in trees.
Herons nest in trees,
you.
And so they're safe from a lot of predators on the ground, like foxes or things like rats.
But the crane are on the ground.
The crane on the ground, so their chicks and their eggs are very vulnerable. So that's an issue for them. Just to check up in Donegal, how have they been getting on there? What sort of habitat are they living in, and what are they eating when they're with you?
In Wild Ireland, I had about a 2.5-3 acre area of land that was very boggy. It's peatland, it's very wet, and it wasn't really useful for any other species. So it's an ideal habitat for them. One of the things that they do like to do is sleep standing in water, obviously because the fox can't get to them then. So we actually took in a digger and we dug out some deeper pools for them. Also some little sort of island areas where that they can build their nest, sort of slightly above the water level so that the eggs and the chicks don't get wet. And because it's such a large area as well, they would be exposed to predators otherwise had this area not been so wet. But because they're out there in what's essentially their natural habitat, they're doing quite well. I noticed that they do forage an awful lot. They will eat roots and little pieces of vegetation that they forage themselves. And then we obviously supplement that feeding with a special crane diet. So there's a special pellet that I can buy in. They also love grain as well. They get maize and wheat. And one of their favourites is actually chopped up day-old chicks. So they are omnivores. And I'm quite sure they're catching, because the area that they live in is so large, I'm quite sure they're catching their own frogs and catching their own little rodents and things that might be out there. Now, one of the interesting things about their extinction in Ireland is that it's very difficult. In Britain, they can sort of identify that the cranes went extinct when they started to drain the bogs and the peatland there. However, we didn't have that large-scale drainage in Ireland until after the cranes had disappeared.
Particularly not in the blanket bogs. I mean, they lasted for a very long time.
Exactly. And even today, there is some habitat here that would still be suitable to sustain cranes. Now, one of the interesting theories that I have read about is that when the wolves started to become rarer in Ireland, the fox population then increased. And the foxes, of course, are one of the natural predators of the crane, particularly young cranes. So perhaps as the wolf population decreased, the fox numbers were no longer kept in check by their larger cousins. And perhaps that might have contributed. And of course, as you rightly point out, Niall, the rats are also an issue, and rats are one of those creatures that are often overlooked. Yeah. Rats are fantastically intelligent animals and everything else, but they do a lot of damage, and I've seen rats myself raiding nests and taking eggs and chicks. So,
and they can swim too, of course. So
they can swim indeed, yeah,
them.
Of course they can.
Yeah, so in fact, your cranes now that you have, are you not worried they'll fly away, or have you pinioned them, and do you have to do that regularly, or how does that work?
Pinioning cranes is, number one, it's considered cruel. Pinioning any animal is actually considered cruel and is going to be phased out over the foreseeable future, which is quite a good thing. What I have done with my cranes is they grow a new set of flight feathers every year, and the flight feathers are divided into their primary and secondary. So what we do is on one wing, we leave the initial primary feathers, and then we just cut the flight feathers behind that. It doesn't cause them any harm. It doesn't hurt them or anything like that. And basically, my cranes can still fly. However, when they lift off the ground, it imbalances them a little bit and they come back down again. Now, the larger cranes need to be able to have the use of their wings in order to mate, because the male has to get on top of the female and he uses his wings to get there. So a pinioned bird, just to let you know what pinioning is, a little procedure carried out when any bird hatches where they nip off the tip of the wing. It's quite barbaric. It would be the equivalent of cutting off our arm at the elbow, because that little nib at the end of the wing will eventually develop into the rest of the wing as the bird grows. So that procedure is frowned upon now.
Killian, you mentioned the extinction in England. The last known reference to a crane dates from the 1500s, an advertisement for a young crane for sale. Now, the important date after that is 1979, when juvenile pair showed up in the Norfolk Broads. And about 2 years later, they started breeding. A colony has built up, and they're now fairly well distributed in England. Now, one of the mysteries for me is that 20 years on, in the Somerset Levels, there was a movement to reintroduce cranes there, and 20 young cranes were brought in there to start a new colony in the Somerset Levels. And now, it always intrigued me, if the birds are there already and their numbers are increasing naturally, why go to the trouble of introducing new ones? And this must be the pattern you're looking at for an introduction here in Ireland sometime in the future.
I would love to see cranes back in Ireland and to hear their mysterious call back over the countryside again. And if my cranes can contribute to that, that would be a dream come true for me to be involved in something.
If your birds breed and you have escapees, is that not going to be an issue? You don't have a license to introduce them to Ireland. Presumably, you've just got a license to bring them into your wildlife park.
Correct, Eric. And there's an awful lot of paperwork and an awful lot of studies that would have to be carried out before the cranes would just be released. And, you know, there's been talk recently of reintroducing wolves, and that's like nails on a blackboard to me. When you reintroduce an animal, you have to imagine it as a pyramid, and the animal that you're reintroducing is the last block to go on the top of that pyramid. Each block below that has to be in place, and obviously the foundation of that pyramid is the correct habitat. Now, interestingly, I have a large lake. It's a man-made lake. I excavated it myself, and there's lots of birds live on that, lots of rescue rescue birds, lots of injured, and they're waterfowl, of course. Mm. And interestingly, a lot of migrating waterfowl use my lake to land. They obviously see my birds on the lake and they fly in and they socialise with my own birds. It would be really interesting if some crane were flying across Donegal and they heard the calls of my birds and maybe came down and landed and nested. It would be quite interesting.
That's what you're really hoping for then, clearly.
Attracted a wild one, then it wasn't your fault. Yes.
But there's a very good case, Killian, for reintroducing these, it would seem to me. But the rule in reintroductions is that the conditions which created the extinction in the first place no longer exist. Now, we don't kill cranes, they ate cranes. Henry II, when he came to Dublin in 1172, he ate cranes for the first time and forced all the Norman lords to do likewise. And they hated it at first, but then it caught on and crane became a great delicacy in Ireland. But anyway, we don't kill them now, but we have, as you mentioned, the fox. The fox is now much more numerous. He is a real problem. But basically, you need a rather large area. The fenlands of East Anglia are suitable for cranes because they're so vast. We have nothing like that kind of vast space here. And even if we had, you could only have one or two pairs in the amount of habitat we have got. We're never going to have a large number. What do you think?
I'd like to see a study carried out first to identify an area. As I said, the foundation of any reintroduction programme is the suitable habitat. Somebody with more expertise and that sort of stuff than me could carry out that study. And if it was found that we had the habitat and I had the suitable birds, there's a difference in importing birds for release and releasing domestically bred birds. I think the domestically bred birds are a lot easier to get through the paperwork and the red tape to reintroduce them. So, you know, if my birds breed, then they're there. We have a foundation population, a safety net population, and if anything ever came up that these birds could go back to the wild, it would be a fantastic...
Our own Larkin O'Toole now, who we know from Eagles and the introducing the golden... The reintroduction of the golden eagle. He wrote a book on cranes, a great big book on cranes. He's ferociously interested in all of these. And the amount of place names around the country from Cor, I'm just thinking of Rock, Corrie, Cortlock, where my own brother lives. All of these things have Cor in the name of them. The Irish name for the Cor, Coriasca is the Irish name for the heron. So Cor is still remembered in the name of the heron. So it was absolutely widespread around the country and people knew about it because of the place names. That it's such a common... I mean, there are not that many place names so frequently called after birds as there is over the crane.
And of course, it's a species that draws attention to itself because it is so massive. It's generally the biggest bird that you would see walking around. You know, it's bigger than many teenage children. It's a huge creature. It's certainly... how tall it stands. It would have been a species, I suppose, that would have really stuck out in the landscape.
I still can't get over the idea that it was a pet. It's in my head.
You see, one of the things is...
as a pet.
Cranes tend to imprint.
Birds imprint, don't they?
To a degree, but cranes particularly, because you sometimes see in some of these rehabilitation programs and reintroduction programs they're doing for other related species, like the whooping crane in North America, one of the world's rarest birds, an even bigger species of crane. And what they would do is to encourage these birds to migrate. They had to teach them to fly the route using microlight aircraft.
Yeah.
And so they would get them to imprint upon the
same
person.
Same as the hooper swans.
Exactly the same thing, yes.
So remember, Derek, we saw that at Pictuxent. We saw the whooping cranes there and we saw the people feeding them through the thing in that visit all those years ago.
There's a couple of spots in County Wexford, for example, where you, every few years at least, you expect to see a few cranes turning up. Places like Cahor and Tecumseh Lake, areas like that where they've been, you know, we're still only talking a small handful, but it's the start of something. Hopefully this bird will come back.
On the issue of an animal being a pet.
Yes.
When you see these birds, they're so majestic and I can see the attraction. Many stately homes now have peacocks around the grounds and I can see the attraction. I've heard that stately homes in the old days would have had cranes roaming the grounds. When the cranes arrived initially, they stayed at the other end of the wetland from us and they were very nervous, but they very quickly learned who fed them. So they don't have to be imprinted even to become accustomed to humans and come up to them. And this is all stuff that I am learning, having gotten to know these birds personally. And there is a huge distinction to be drawn between reading about an animal in a book or watching it on TV and actually seeing it in the flesh. In fact, a friend of mine came to visit Wild Ireland recently and the cranes called right in front of him for the first time, and he actually welled up. His eyes became teary because he was so overwhelmed by the noise. And I have to say, the noise is really something else when you're standing beside them.
Thanks, Killian. There's a man who knows his stuff and big dreams, and those dreams are coming a reality for him at least. But when I think of a pet, I think of something that's been led around on a leash. I don't think of ornamental species.
You need to broaden your mind, Derek.
There actually are reports of cranes being led around on leashes, just
really?
Like dogs. Yeah, absolutely. I remember. Oh God, it was when I was a child. But I remember being in Black Rock and seeing someone taking several geese for a walk on a lead as well on the street. So yeah.